This is Tribeca Talks, our favorite conversations recorded live at the Tribeca Film Festival. I'm Leah Sarbib. Lena Dunham was first discovered for her original voice in breakout film Tiny Furniture. She then created and starred in Girls, which was executive produced and co-written by Jenny Connor. Over the course of its six-season run, Girls was nominated for 2 Emmys for Outstanding Comedy Series, a Golden Globe for Best Comedy Television Series, a BAFTA for Best International Show, and Dunham won a Golden Globe for her performance as Hannah Horvath. Connor and Dunham went on to co-create the limited series Camping for HBO. They were interviewed together at the 2017 Tribeca Film Festival by America Ferreira, award-winning actress, director, and producer known for her breakthrough role as Betty Suarez on the hit comedy Ugly Betty.
Thank you.
We're so honored because besides each other, this is our favorite person on the fucking planet.
We cannot wait to work on her campaign for president, right? Yeah. I'm not kidding.
America for America is such an easy slogan that there's just no reason for us not to start now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I think we should announce it right now.
I'm going to stop you guys there. I just want to say, I guess this is the theme of the night. I feel so insanely lucky to be on this stage with the two of you, who are both inspirations, I think, to me and to millions and millions of others. I can still remember what it felt like to watch the first episode of Girls and be alive and tingling with that feeling of, holy shit, we've never seen this before. And why that was so exciting was it just opened my imagination of what was to come. If Hannah Horvath could live on television, what door is she opening for the many, many, many representations of women that we have yet to see to exist on television? And I know I've said this to both of your faces and on text, but I truly believe that you changed the landscape of television and beyond for women and how they see themselves and what they think is possible for their voices.
Thank you.
And hearing that from you is so surreal because I remember thinking when we were putting the show together and I was sort of like, aren't I supposed to just cast somebody who's like the kind of fun television version of me, whose like hair works a little better and who has a general easier time getting out of bed in the morning? And I just remember thinking of you as one of the people who, I mean, here's the funny thing is like you look at America and it's like, it's the most fucking beautiful woman you've ever seen in your life. It's amazing to be in a room with her. So the fact that she was one of the examples of a non-traditional person you could see on television is sort of a fucking joke because I'm like next to the great bombshell of all time.
But I was at the first upfronts America ever did. And I remember what you said there, which someone asked you one of those questions that we all get asked all the time. About like being untraditional or non-traditional. And you said, until I got on television, I didn't know I wasn't pretty or that I was fat. And I was like, who is that girl? She's my new best friend.
It's so true.
Well, that, I mean, let's just, because we're there, let's just skip to that question because having played Ugly Betty on television, I got so much of, you're not ugly. You're so pretty. Like people wanting me to know that I wasn't ugly. Yeah. And I still get that. And I was 21 when I started that. You were 23 when you started Girls. Yeah. And when you're in it, you don't know what to make of it other than to say like, thank you. But in retrospect, I find it so messed up that through all of the work that I did, the thing that people thought was the bravest thing a woman could do on television was be ugly. I thought that was so indicative of something that was wrong in our culture and that the way we were having the conversation about women. And I can only imagine, Lena, how much you got and how much you get from the beginning about your body and it not being traditional and what bravery and what courage or what gall or, you know, no shame or all the different things people want to throw at you. I'm sure you've been getting your own fair share of that for years and years.
Yeah, I mean, Jenny, those are the questions that drive Jenny the most insane. Yes,
those are the ones, like, I lived through it first season, and I was like, okay, this is first season, and people are working it out. They are working it out. Men, generally, very angry that she felt comfortable showing her body.
Yeah.
And we'd hear a lot of it subtly and non-subtly. But then, I think it was like third season.
Yeah.
Someone, a reporter from The Wrap, raised his hand at the TCAs and said, why do you show your body so much? And it was in that tone and it was that hostile. And I lost my mind.
She had a rage spiral blackout.
I did. Fully. Like, someone asked me a question like 2 minutes later, and I was like, I'm so sorry. I'm in a rage spiral blackout, so I didn't hear what you said because I'm still so mad about what that guy said.
And then it was kind of amazing. Like, I'm not a big proponent of the room turning on someone, but this was pretty dope. Like, yeah. Everyone was just like, this dude sucks. Like, and then at one point, Judd was like, just so you know, he was like, do you have a girlfriend? And the guy was like, yeah. And Judd was like, your girlfriend doesn't like you. And it was the most, he was like, there's no way she likes you. And
but also it was like third season. I was like, dude, Google it. We've answered that question.
And it's also this
times.
Thing, like Amy Schumer, who's one of our best friends, said this thing in her latest special where she was like, I did a naked picture. I felt gorgeous. And then I found out the worst compliment you can get for going naked on television, which is you can be revered as so brave. And it's like, I mean, Jenny said this about me recently, which is I've always been like Rihanna to myself. Like, I just have a great time with my own body. And it's, I really at any size, I've been a range of sizes for a range of reasons. And it's always felt good to me. And it was an interesting thing because I think people were so ready to believe that I was like jumping past some massive hurdle in order to get naked on television. And I was like, that's not where my fear lies. If that's what scared me, I wouldn't do it every week. And
you might. I mean, just you do things that scare you.
I do things that scare
me. That's not one of them.
And the interesting thing was also the hostility I got. I really tried to take it in and understand. And so often it was coming from people who also didn't have perfect bodies, whether it was like, you know, chubby men in the Midwest or
no, it's
women.
Not like Emily Ratajkowski or whatever.
No,
it's
and
like,
the interesting,
how dare you?
The interesting thing is some of the most love and compliments I've gotten have been from women who are considered to have sort of perfect and beautiful bodies, who I think feel the constant pressure to maintain those bodies and have felt like some level of, who have seemed like they felt freed in some way by seeing me say fuck it a little bit. But there have been lots of women who are like, who seem irate that I would kind of pardon myself from the punishments that we're all doling out to ourselves
of the today. Shame.
So let's unpack that a little bit, because I agree. I feel like in the conversations that I was having about girls when it came out, that was a big part of it. Women friends I had who had lifelong struggles with their own bodies, didn't know how they felt about you being on screen. And and I think that right there is almost more important than how the men reacted, right?
Like, absolutely.
Why do we react, especially when it does feel like a closer representation? Do you feel like you have any clarity on what that might be about or what that's pointing to in how women feel about themselves?
Well, so interesting. I remember like when Tiny Furniture first came out, seeing some of the reviews and a film critic who was a woman who I really, really, really admired her writing. She sort of straddled the line between film and art world. And she was someone who I had seen around for years and I kind of loved her look. She had like long gray braids and she kind of didn't seem like she like cared about fashion on her own terms. She was sort of a role model to me. And I remember, I'll never forget, she said that I like flashed my slovenly ass and thighs. And I will never forget the kind of violence and specificity of that language and thinking, okay, this woman is in her 60s. She clearly has been given the message that her body was not fit for public consumption, whether that had been coming from childhood, whether that had been coming from the expectations of being in like the downtown New York fashion and art world. But I just remember feeling her anger in those words and thinking like, God, I guess that's why I'm here, it doesn't feel good to get that from another woman. But I guess part of why I'm here is to try to relieve a little bit of that pressure. And
I think people feel so angry that they don't feel as comfortable as Lena. I think that people like us can have a hard time because she's so comfortable and we've struggled our whole life to be comfortable and could never do something like that. And like, I remember we were interviewing a writer once for a job and she said, because of you, I now feel comfortable having sex on top. And I was like, oh, that's like the greatest compliment, you know, like that's what we want. I mean, it wasn't in any way by design, but I saw Tiny Furniture and there's literally a scene that's like a minute and a half. This is long before I knew Lena, but there's a scene that's like a minute and a half where she's putting on a full body Spanx. And it is one of the truest, purest moments I've ever seen on film. Like, that was the moment that I was like, I must work with her. Like,
and then this past season, you were like, as an ode, please, can we film 5 minutes of you trying to get on a wetsuit?
Yeah.
And it was really, it was harder than the Spanx.
Yeah.
But.
Well, as somebody who didn't wear a bathing suit in public from middle school on, I will say that the shift in our culture, the small niches that we've been able to create, starting with girls, maybe Ugly Betty was in there, the Amy Schumer.
Maybe.
Of the world.
Are you into
it? Definitely.
Those little niches and places of safety where we get to see ourselves have taken me from being somebody who wore the t-shirt to someone who's flashing my bikini body on the beach. So,
and by the way, having been in a hot tub with you, I know what's happening and it's
triathlete.
But
now.
And all of that to say that it's not about starting and ending with how we feel about our bodies. To me, I feel like it's more and more about how do we get over the distraction of what our bodies are supposed to look like so we can go on to direct and write and produce and create.
Well, I think about that all the time because we put so much energy into thinking about our bodies. As you say, that it's like there's not any room left in your day for anything else, like any obsession. And, you know, the piece you wrote for The Times about doing your first triathlon, and now it's so annoying, she just like keeps doing triathlons.
It's gonna be the cover girl for Triathlon magazine. For real.
Literally,
that's
she's
real.
Going to be on the
first
cover.
Of all, there's a triathlon magazine. Second of all, she's the cover girl. I think that's the hottest thing in the world.
We're freaking out about it. But that piece inspired me so much because you were pushing beyond the narrative of I feel comfortable with my body now. And you're also saying, and now I'm asking my body to do new things for me. And I'm, by loving it, my body is returning the favor. And as a person who's, you know, been told by so many different voices that my body was wrong or should be hidden or shouldn't be seen. And also as a person who's struggled with my health, that was like such a powerful message to me. And I also want to return to something you said when you started off, which was that what you felt when you saw girls was that there was going to be space for a lot of female voices, because that's what I felt when I first saw you come on the scene. Even when I just saw Real Women Have Curves, and I thought like, oh, we're opening, we're fanning out now. But also, I think something people misunderstood with girls was that we were never trying to be the one and only quintessential show about femaleness. We were trying to be a show about femaleness and hoping to make a little space for other people to do the same thing. And it became complicated because there's such a sort of, there isn't room in this town for the both of us thing going on with women in Hollywood.
Well, Richard always said, Richard Shepherd, who directed the pilot of Ugly Betty, who's one of our directors, he's my boyfriend, he did all the like bottle episodes of Girls, but he always said, I think you would have gotten so much less trouble if you had just called it Girl. Like, it was the fact that it made it seem like we were trying to be everybody.
Yes, and I think that that's a conversation worth having, and you were getting here, Lena, which is when there are so few opportunities for us to see ourselves, we put so much pressure on any given show, book, movie to represent all of us, and it's disappointing when it doesn't necessarily align and represent everything that you are, but also we can begin to cannibalize and suffocate our own leaders who are out there being brave, taking steps, telling their story to create space where more stories can come through. And I think it was really hard to sit back and watch you and the show get criticized for everything that it wasn't when we should have been applauding you for stepping forward. And so many did, and so many of us do, but stepping forward and telling your story. And to that end, in terms of creating a show like Girls, making a show like Girls possible, so much of being able to do that is about who you surround yourself with. And I feel like Jenny is as much a part of the story of Girls in my conversations with you and in everything you've said in the press. And I think I met Jenny before I met you and heard about Girls initially from Jenny. How did you guys find each other?
It's a great question.
It's really romantic, through our agents.
Through your agents.
Okay, so the good part of the story, though, that is kind of romantic is that I had been told about Tiny Furniture by Liz Merriweather, who's the showrunner and creator of The New Girl. And she said, oh, there's this 23-year-old who made this movie at South by Southwest. She's in her underwear the whole time. And I was like, pass. And she was like, no, I swear you'll love it. And then Sue Nagel, who was then the president of HBO, had me watch it just as a person. Like, what do you think? I think I asked her about it. And she said, oh, I have a copy of it. And I became so obsessed with it that I would make, this is where on a live streaming event, I actually admit that I'm a bootlegger, but I would make copies of it and give it to people. Not because I like had any intention of anything, just because I was like, everyone needs to see this movie. It was one of those movies that I thought was very, very important for everyone to see, and it hadn't come out yet. So I'm sorry if I hurt your box office. But
I feel like it was really okay, and that the like isolated group of industry people were like probably not going to trek it out to the Lemley 5 anyway.
Jed called me the unofficial distributor of Tiny Furniture.
Well, the funny.
So when she needed a supervisor and made a deal for a blind script at HBO, they were like, should we call her Secret Stalker? And that's how.
And then we just found, and I posted on my Instagram last week, the letter, the email that I wrote to my agent right after getting off the phone with Jenny, in which I was sort of trying to gauge, like, it was very dating, like, was Jenny pretending to be interested and then gonna, or was she, did she actually want me back? Because I was like, she had said to me, you should talk to everyone in this very generous way, like, meet a bunch of people, it's such a specific relationship. But I was like, but I don't want to meet a bunch of people. I was like, I just like you. And so then he, I remember, went and called her and said, the feeling is mutual. And then the next day, and our relationship, I don't know if you remember this, but like this set the precedent for our whole relationship, which is like, we were like emailing nonstop for a few days. And then Jenny went away to a Jewish camp for adults.
Yeah.
And
I was getting divorced. It was a really weird time. I would kind of try anything.
So she was at Jewish camp for adults, and I was like,
it's called Reboot.
Emailing her a lot, and she wasn't emailing me back. And I was like, she either hates me or she's dead. And that now, and that very early on, Jenny found out exactly what kind of codependent I was, because she finally like got to her email, and there were like 9 for me that was like, if I said anything that offended you, just let me know. I was like,
she cycles all the way through.
I was like,
and back out again. You're mad at me, and now I'm mad at you for being mad at me.
Yeah.
Like, she has the whole fight, the whole breakup, the whole remarriage.
We were back together, and then
by the time I got there,
I'm in Utah. Like, yeah. But I was. So she knew really early on. And then it was really evident. I mean, it's so funny for me because honestly, like when I see the Created by Lena Dunham credit come up on the show, like I said this to Jenny a lot. Like, I know I technically created it, but it's like that doesn't feel right
to me.
Okay,
that is such crap. Let me just say something.
Okay.
When Lena came as a fully formed creative force, and anyone who's seen Tiny Furniture knows that. And one of the reasons I think we had such an easy time making Girls, because HBO is sort of famous for taking a really long time to decide, and they're not on the network schedule, so it could just be years you could be sitting in development before they even order the pilot. But we came there, and I think this is like actually a great thing for people who are interested in making television everywhere. We basically had a template. So it was like we had Tiny Furniture, we had the lead of our show, we had the director of our show, we had the look of the show because we had the same DP. And we were like, it's going to be like this, but with more girls and funnier.
So where did the idea for Girls come? Before Jenny?
Or it was did. It? I'm telling you, she says, I was very instrumental, as was Judd, and we all worked together beautifully. But honestly, this was a very, very pure voice that spoke to both Judd and I and HBO. And at the beginning, all we were afraid of, because we had had so much network experience, was like protecting her voice. And it turns out at HBO, you don't have to. They love it too. So
they were amazing. And what they did was they asked Judd, sort of used his big Judd power to get them to order not one, but four scripts. And so I sort of went off. I told them the basic gist of what I was going to do, went off and wrote four scripts, which vaguely resemble the first four episodes of Girls.
Yes.
They changed a lot. And then...
and they were reordered. The abortion used to be number one.
I know. And then they were like, you know what? We love you a lot. We think that we should keep the abortion out of the first episode. Let's just...
they're like, we might want to get to know the characters before they're throwing an abortion party.
Yep. And so, it was like there was even more talk of abortion party before we peeled that back a little.
Yeah, but I remember Judd being like, it's like if Kramer killed a puppy in the pilot.
Yeah, and I was like, I know. We were like, it was for me, I was like, it was so obvious that none of these characters would ever keep a child and that all of them would be like coming from a liberal arts school and wouldn't have any particularly like strong emotions about it besides like, let's get this done and support each other. And Judd was like, I think you're like not quite properly estimating America's feelings on this issue.
And by the way, they let us do it second. So it wasn't like they fought us on it. They were just like, how about we have another one first?
Yeah.
So in having all those conversations about like, what's the audience ready for? Who were you making this show for?
I mean, I remember, it's funny because I remember thinking I wanted to see a show about people, the kind of people that I spent time with and the kind of women who were my friends who I didn't feel like I'd seen on television before. But I've also never really felt, and Jenny can say this, I've never really felt, you and I have talked about this, my age. Like, I never really felt like a 20-something. I felt like a weird, like Bill Cunningham standing outside the fashion show observer of being a 20-something. So in many ways, playing Hannah is, like, the closest I've felt to being a 20-something in the traditional sense. I share certain qualities with her, but, like, I never had... quite had 20-something dreams, goals, desires, social life. And so in many ways, it was like I felt like a kind of weird alien who was like, I think that people my age might enjoy this show. Like,
and I can speak to that because knowing you and knowing about you, you sort of fly in the face of every stereotype about a millennial. You never waited for permission. You went out, you made your stuff. You've worked so hard. On top of writing, directing, starring in the show, you started Lenny Letter, which is like a gift to all
Thank
of us.
We just announced a tour today. We're going,
yeah, we're
on,
going
tour
on tour.
Of
we're really
you have a book imprint. I mean, the amount of things you do and the amount of self-actualization you do. I don't know you as Hannah, but watching the show and not knowing you, I would think, well, she's so natural. Maybe that's just who she is. So is she this millennial who is so lost in life, or is she saying something about millennials? And is that a conversation you guys had about what are we trying to say, or what are we adding to the conversation about millennials?
We never really had that conversation. Like, we never really talked about the bigger picture. It was always very small. And again, the good news about working with HBO is that you don't even really have to talk about who your audience is and yeah. who you think might watch it, because you can be like, maybe no one will. But it was, I think the conversations that we had were sort of about how terrible is Hannah?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, I remember in the pilot, there are two envelopes at the very end that her parents leave, and one's for housekeeping and one's for her. And she takes both of them. And I remember someone gave us feedback after the pilot and was like, she shouldn't take the housekeeping one. And we were like, yeah, she should.
Yeah.
And it's one of those, like, you know, I think that those were our kind of conversations, more like, how far are we pushing Hannah rather than how far are we pushing our viewers?
And it's so funny because I feel like I've told you this, Jenny, but I maybe haven't said it publicly, which is I sort of had my, like, Hannah summer. Like, I graduated from college in May of 2008. I spent a year working in a children's clothing store with my two best friends, which was really just an excuse to behave deplorably.
It was, like, also a plot in and out of Girls 400 times.
Literally all
there was like a note card on the board
always
every season that they were all going to work at a baby's clothing, child's
and
clothing
we did
card.
End up putting Jessa in
we
one.
We did. That was like the closest we got.
I initially was like, should my pilot just be about girls who work at a baby clothing store? Then I was like, that feels small, but it was a big, it was a big thing. But I spent the, I had this year where I had always been like a kid who didn't have a tremendous social life and spent a lot of time working on projects. Like I was always like sort of, my parents both worked at home, so I had like my desk where I was sort of working on projects. And I spent a year after graduating from college, I really, really lost sight of the part of myself that felt connected to making things. I really lost sight of the part of myself. I felt really far away from myself. And I remember like, you know, working at the children's clothing store, it became warm. I behaved deplorably. I lived with my parents. I misused their cookware and, you know, ruined my mom's Le Creuset pot and then threw it in the garbage on the corner. I, you know, drove my dad's car without a license. I was verbally abusive when I was caught doing it. I had sex with the very wrongest people. And then I remember it was like, I was just on this tear and I was like, how far can this go? And then like end of August, my back went out because that's who I am. And so I was like, I'm really living. And then like my back went out and I basically just lay still for 2 weeks and was like, this isn't really me. And I wrote the script for Tiny Furniture and that's what kind of brought me out of that phase. And so a lot of Hannah's sort of like darkest moments or most sort of like gauche, horrible things she's done, like literally came out of this just year and a half. And after it ended and I started making things again, I was like, oh, that's what it's like to not know yourself and to feel depressed and alone and broken and scared. And there was so much that I wasn't dealing with after having graduated from college that starting to making the movie and then starting to make the show allowed me to deal with. And the other thing I think is when you said, you know, are you this character? You do all the stuff. I think the biggest thing that I would recommend to everybody who feels like they want, that they have big ambition and don't quite understand how to tackle it, is to find a partner who has a shared vision. It totally changes your, people go like, how do you get so much done? I'm like, we get so much done and we share the burden and we know how hard it is to be, I mean, I don't know how hard it is to be a mother, but we know how hard it is to be women balancing things in this world, and we pass it back and forth and we hold what the other can't at different times. And that is the like sort of, that is the great gift that's allowed us to dream bigger.
You know, one of the things that the show and you ladies do in your individual lives is you live at kind of the threshold where things aren't necessarily comfortable and you're pushing yourselves and you're pushing culture forward. And for that, you get love. And for that, sometimes you get hate and a lot of criticism. And I think it's a really worthy conversation to talk about how that criticism affects you and your work. You know, some of it, I imagine, you have to learn to protect yourself against. And some of it, I imagine, you have to let in and allow to affect you as a creative person. So talk about that. Over the years, the reaction to girls and some of the stories you were telling, were there any reactions that you learned from that you thought, huh, we hadn't seen it that way?
Yeah, the diversity conversation, absolutely. And it wasn't like we didn't know, but it opened a conversation for all of us to have that we really appreciated and tried to make better.
It inspired us in starting Lenny and in trying to think about supporting women's voices the way that we had been supported. And the fact is like you learn a lot from a smart, thoughtful person letting you know where they think your blind spots are. But it's a really interesting thing because, you know, you don't want to tone police people, but it's like, nobody, I forget who recently said, I think it was Linda Sarsour, that nobody ever learned from being shamed. And so it felt like there was this fine line between these really thoughtful criticisms and this just desire to sort of almost shame us out of having a voice. And I felt like there was this, when I would look at the comments, it was this generalized sort of, when will she fucking stop? And that's something I know that lots of women in public experience, which is that like, somehow certain sections of the internet think that if they just direct enough negativity at you, you're going to retreat and then they can move on to their next, you know, whack-a-mole target.
I always say that Lena's headstone will say she read the comments. Because I do think, you know, that kind of internet trolling, that there's nothing to come of that. There's literally nothing good that can come. There's nothing thoughtful that can come. It's honestly, no one even watches the show who has that kind of comments. It's the thoughtful, considered comments and smart people writing about it or talking to us about it that has had an effect.
That opens our brains up. Yeah. I've always wondered, like, because now, especially now that you're a producer on Superstore, like, do you make it your business to read what's written about the show?
I will only read when someone has read it first and told me it's good.
Yeah.
That's right. Like, yeah. You're not, because there was a moment where I sort of wondered, I was like, we produce this show, it's in the world. There was a moment where I was like, is it our job to read and know everything?
Yeah.
To be.
And Jed was like, no. Yeah.
He was like, don't even read the, he's like, I try to do this, I fail, but don't even read the good ones. Yeah. He was like, there's just no point.
And honestly, this year is like the first year since the first season that I've actually like re-engaged with reading thought pieces. And reviews, because everyone seems to have amnesia and act like we've just been beloved for the last six
Absolutely.
Seasons.
It's
and I'm
so
like,
weird.
All for that fantasy.
It's so weird. It's sort of like if you just got like, I mean, not to compare internet trolling to being beaten up, but I guess I'm about to do it, which is like, it's like if you just got beat up, you showed up at a party like covered in bruises and everyone was like, you look amazing. Yeah. Like, I'm like, what the fuck is going
and
on?
And you always have.
And you always have. And nothing. And it's just, it's been such a fascinating ride, because it's like when you have a fight with a friend and they say a bunch of really bitchy stuff to you, the next day they're like, I'm sorry, let's go to brunch. And you're like, but I still remember that you said really mean stuff yesterday.
Yeah.
And I think at the time, we were so focused on just trying to make the most pure and authentic thing that we could, yeah. that we couldn't really let ourselves know that the criticism was having an effect. But it was like, you know, one of our crew members who we love, David Scutch, came to work and told me a story about almost getting in a fight with a guy at his, you know, ice hockey league who was speaking negatively about my body. Like, just the way that people around us had to defend us and care for us and push back, and the amount of emails we got that were like, are you guys okay? It was a lot. And I think we're still understanding it has to have an effect on your psyche, even if you don't know.
Absolutely. And that's my question, is like, you're strong and you have an incredible support system and obviously a creative ambition that keeps you going. But when certain things do get to you, how do you deal with that personally? How do you physically get the negativity out of your body and get back up and get back to the work?
Well, mine is very different from hers, because she plays the lead of the show that people associate with her. So often people are mad at Hannah and talking to her like she is Hannah. And there's so much vitriol that's very personal. No one's ever like, Jenny Connor, that scene you wrote is so, you know, it was much more like a generalized yeah. thing about the show.
But you took it in also because we have such a symbiotic relationship that, like, if I was yes. in a place of distress.
No, I mostly took it on, yeah, for her, which is better, because then you're just protective and that's a better place to be than wounded, or a safer place, I guess, to be than wounded. But, we did start meditating pretty heavily. We started doing TM with David Lynch Foundation.
Which we love.
Which we love during the second season.
Yep,
I think.
Second season. That was
We got other crew members involved. Like, that was, like, I think a
we
real
We started really
thing.
Focusing, like, Jenny is an aggressive Tracy Anderson method doer, and we got... I got really into yoga this year.
Yeah, we started bringing Tracy trainers to the set to work out our crew before it started. I think all of that was kind of like, how are we going to process this out of our bodies?
Yeah, and I think the hardest thing was like...
And we got sick a lot. And I don't believe that that's an accident.
No, we both had real challenging health episodes during the show. And I think we have a phenomenon in this country. I don't want to be spewing fake science, but like, it's really interesting.
I love fake science.
I love fake science too. But
it's really
interesting. Like, it's not a coincidence, I don't think, that the majority of people with autoimmune diseases are women, because men project their rage outwards and women attack themselves. And so that feeling of that, it was that feeling of like, I'm so proud of what we've made, but people are trying to people's anger and their attempts to silence us, as much as you can sort of dismiss it intellectually, your body takes it in. And I think the ones that were really hard were when it wasn't like I can take whatever like the alt-right wants to say, like that's fine. Those aren't people.
Because you're like, that's bonkers. That's like, yeah. Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, you don't totally. It's it. Like, I can't even understand what they're saying. It's insane. Everyone that I know and love knows it's insane. It was when I felt misunderstood or willfully misunderstood by other women who shared my politics that things were really hard. I had to really, like this year, I took a real look at the way that I was engaging with media, and I took a real look at how careful I needed to be when there was a comment that I made about abortion on my podcast that was, I mean, I'm not even going to say taken out of context because I made a joke and people had a really negative reaction to it. And I just thought, like, Jenny and I talked a lot about it. We were like, as Jenny said, I would crawl over broken glass to protect your freedom of speech, but it's like, it's not worth it when something is like a light throwaway accident to have this level of backlash and to deal with this level of backlash. And especially as someone who's devoted a lot of their adult life to reproductive choice, justice, and freedom, to be misunderstood by other pro-choice feminists was like hell to me. And so that was when I started thinking, like, I really need to be more strategic. I was always very resistant to the idea of being strategic because I saw it as sort of like almost corporatizing your persona. And I was like, I think you and I talked about this a lot after the election, which is like, there's times when you have to be strategic. You just do.
And I think that the value in sharing that process that you two go through with an audience of creative people who maybe they're in the entertainment industry, but maybe they're just looking to use their voices in their own industries in the world, is if we stick to this idea that the people who change culture are these like superhero people who don't get affected by the world, then that puts a barrier between us and being able to do it. But the reality is you're people and your body gets sick and you get impacted emotionally, and sometimes it's hard, and yet you do it anyway. And that's what I think is the miracle of you. And the fact that when you have made mistakes, you've been very open about talking about them and saying...
Lena's one of the great apologizers. but she means it very genuinely. She won't apologize if she doesn't believe it. There are plenty of things she says that people are outraged by, and she is not going to apologize. But when she feels misunderstood and when she feels like it hasn't, the what she was trying to say wasn't made clear, that's when she gets apologetic. And it's almost the wrong word, because it's like there's more of it's an explanation than an apology a lot of the time. But it's always being misunderstood. It's never...
It's like you want to make sure that you haven't... I mean, you and I have talked about this. It's like you apologize when you have a gut level that you have a gut level feeling that you may have hurt people who you want to connect with. And people may have misunderstood your intentions or think you're dismissing them when that's the last thing that you want. And it's interesting, like, you and I talk about this a lot, America. Like, after the election, when you and I were so openly sad and we were really struggling, I remember you and I talked about how we were struggling with how vulnerable to be about how devastated we were, because it is, you know, it's, we could have, you know, shared thousands of selfies of ourselves crying. It's like, how far do you go?
I shared a couple hundred of myself crying.
Yeah. And they were beautiful because they looked like beautiful film stills. But the thing is you are, our culture has such a sort of complex relationship to vulnerability, and people want to be born as these fully formed, perfect beings who get it right all the time. And we can't be that. And apologizing, just like in an interpersonal relationship, apologizing to your audience or to your fans or to whoever, like, that's a form of vulnerability that, for me, it's not always comfortable, but it's really important. And
I think it also is so inspiring that you know, your brand is live and learn, basically. And I think that allows other people to do that.
Absolutely. And I think specifically for women, we tend to hear this feeling of you don't want to take a step without knowing you're going to succeed, without knowing you're bulletproof. And Jenny, in this, you started directing episodes of Girls.
Right.
And what was that like for you, stepping into a new arena? When did you finally feel ready to say, like, yeah, I'm ready to do
literally
that?
not yet. but you know, it got to the point, actually Colin Quinn at some point, who guests on our show, said to me, you got to direct while you're doing this. And I was like, do I? Because I really like writing and I get to engage with the actors as much as I want. In television, the showrunners are like directors in a lot of ways. And so I just thought, well, I get to do all the stuff I love. And then he said, no, you got to try it at least while you have this show going. And I was like, you're right, I have to try it. And all of a sudden I realized, oh no, I don't do all the things that I love. That it's much bigger and I love doing it. And it was the safest space I could have ever done it. It's our crew for 5 years, who I love and adore. It's my family. Everyone had my back. And I even learned to enjoy a tech scout, which I never thought I would.
It was also so funny because in the weeks before, Jenny was nervous and she was literally looking for any excuse. She was like, you know, that script is not looking great. Maybe we get a different director because I think I need to be in the writer's room. Like, she was looking for every excuse. And then the first day she shows up and it's as if she's been doing it forever. She'd been like, you're going to have to be with me every second because I'm really going to need your feedback. And I come over and I'm like, I have a thought. And she's like, can you give me a minute? Like, she is fully in it. It's like all her fears had just evaporated. And I loved it because as an actor, you know, what you love is to feel like someone's leading the charge. Like, and she was immediately. And that was something you and I talked about when you decided to direct Superstore this year. I was like, it was so amazing to me because I kind of thought of you as having like zero. I was like, oh yeah, America, she has no fears. And when you said like that it was a hard thing for you to ask for that, like, why do you think that was when in so many ways you've demanded what you want, not just from your career, but from like the world?
I think that goes directly to the last question I wanted to ask you guys before we open it up to Q&A. I will answer your question, but I have a question for you. You know, I asked to direct an episode of Superstore as a direct result of you telling me that I should direct. You were the first person to say, we're doing this short series, you should direct an episode. And I hadn't thought of myself as a director. And having another colleague, peer, female say to me, you can do this, was made all the difference for me. And even though that didn't end up working out, the confidence stayed. And that is the importance of having people in your life and your network who see you and who see your potential and who are challenging you to move forward. And one of my questions for you guys is, you know, how important is it as women to work with other women who are protecting and moving you forward? Because I know for me, it's made all the difference.
It's made all the difference. I mean,
everything.
All the top people at our show are female, and except for Judd.
Both our
companies are totally female. I think that there's just a different energy that comes out of that. And we work with a lot of men we love. Jesse Peretz, Richard Shepherd, like plenty of people. Judd obviously is like our best friend, but you know, there's something about, like, I think women even crew up differently. I think they crew up in a more sensitive way. Like, they, when they're hiring people, they think like, well, how is this DP going to get along with this gaffer? Like, there's something more emotional about the way they crew up, and it's still picking the best people, but it's, I think that there's like a subconscious choice about relationships and forming a family. And I think that's why we had such a great crew, because Eileen Landris and Regina Heyman were the people who did it for us. Awesome. And by the way, Eileen would totally disagree with me.
Yeah,
she'd be like, no, it's just who we know and whatever, because yeah, she does not like to be that. But I really do think it's true.
I also have to say, like, I've always just been more interested in women. Right. It's what I'm just more interested in them. Like, my female friendships are the great passion area of my life. I'm totally obsessed with the women who surround me. They're my muses. They're the people who I want to write about, who I want to think about, who I want to film. I mean, my mom always tells me that if she held out a book when I was a kid, I would always say, is it written by a girl? Because I just like was like, I don't want to read a book that's written by a boy. That seems so boring. Does it have girls in it? Was always the question about every movie. Like, and I just was obsessed with stories told by females, and I was obsessed with being around women in whatever form that takes. And still, to me, creative validation from other women is like everything. Like, it's something completely different than, and not to dismiss, and I have, we have plenty of great male collaborators, not to dismiss an entire, you know, sex or gender, but it's like, that's, those are the stories I want to tell and the stories I want to hear. And those are the people that I want to tell stories with. Who,
and also we're in a position of power now where, you know, we have not tremendous power, but like, you know, we have our newsletter, Lenny Letter, and we can use that entirely to push the ball forward for women. Entirely female voices finding a place, female illustrators finding a place, you know, that's been really important to us.
Yeah.
And there's obviously been a conversation about women being able to unapologetically say, this is by women for women, and that there's a fear that saying that will isolate too many men.
Right.
What do you guys think about the importance of now, this time in history, and why it matters to say unapologetically, I'm a woman telling stories about women for women?
Well, it's so funny because I always almost think about it like when people are like, you can't say that. You've got to be blind in terms of opportunities. I'm like, that's the same for me as somebody like talking about reverse racism. Like, I just don't think it exists. I think that women for so long have had to fight so hard for their opportunities that it's like, this is our moment to seize, and this is our moment to give to each other what we've always deserved. And this is our, I mean, there was such a long time. Like, one of the things I thought about watching Feud, Ryan Murphy's show, was that the entire, really what the show's about is the fact that there was only ever room for one, and that those days are over, and we can work together and join hands and be, there's strength in numbers rather than the threat of losing an opportunity to a woman who's younger or thinner or whatever. And so it's like, it's our moment to reach out to each other. And I think it should be perfectly acceptable to say, I feel safe, happy, and excited surrounded by a crew of women, which is something that I would never have had the opportunity to have even 10 years ago.
Yeah. So now we're going to take some questions from the audience.
You guys all look polite and fun.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, not a question. I just wanted to thank you for also addressing and incorporating mental health issues, because that's also something that isn't really talked about. And for women, when you were saying that it's something we maybe sometimes internalize, I guess that's something that maybe people also minimize because of maybe just our emotions or this or that. And so I just wanted to thank you for bringing that up as well in your show.
That means so much to us. Thank you. Talking about mental health was so important to Jenny and to me and to Judd, and reminding people that a lot of the people that you know and deal with every day are struggling in ways that are invisible but painful. And so we're so happy that you noticed.
Hi. Little shy being a guy in the context of all that.
But, don't be.
We love you.
Yeah, just so beautifully moved by your introduction of looking at the body image issues. As a dad of a young girl, I often think about how that's going to shake out. But I had a question. You made some real specific choices around Adam, who's really powerfully into his body, and yeah. Jake Lacy and Patrick Wilson, all like kind of studs.
Yeah.
So I was wondering like how interesting that was contrasted against how you're showing up and how this whole dialogue around body image, these guys are like really, so what was that all about?
Well, I will say it's important to note that Adam, while always being very tall, did not, like, he went away and made Star Wars and came back twice his size. Like, I have pictures of myself standing behind him where you can't see me.
Yeah, it's like so funny because when we first cast Adam, he had this, he was really, really obviously incredibly charming, but like he was really powerfully odd.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, oh, here's Hannah and we're casting like Taylor Kitsch as her boyfriend. He came into the audition, we were like, this guy's a freaking weirdo. And like, is the network going to be down with the fact that he
hasn't
like
grown into his looks yet? He became like the handsome movie star that he is now over the season. So, watch, I think on HBO right now, if you have it, there's a thing called Goodbye to Girls. And it's got his audition on it. And it's really worth watching for two reasons. One is that he just looks like a totally different person. And the other is that everyone in the room is women, and it's like those old tapes of the Beatles playing where you can only hear screaming and laughter, because he was so powerful and so good that we were all like, oh my God.
Like when he first came in, I didn't understand it. When I first looked at him, I didn't understand it at all. And it's interesting, like Patrick Wilson, we knew like was a very strong choice. He looks like, you know, a kind of cartoon of a handsome man. And that was really fun. And then in terms of Jake Lacy, who's like, yeah, a great looking, you know, strapping young man. And I saw him in Miss Sloan and was like, oh yeah, Jake Lacy's really handsome. But like, it may again speak to my internalized Rihanna, which is I've never ever felt like I didn't look correct next to those people. I've never had that sensation. Like, actors have come in for roles and I've just gone like, do we have chemistry or do we not? And also in my dating life, it was interesting, like, I've thought about this recently, like, I was kind of like a snobby little looksist in my 20s. I was like, I don't care. I may have cystic acne and be like 30 pounds heavier than you, sir, my sex partner. But like, I feel really that it's correct that you should be in love with me.
I have a question about producing and directing yourself in your own projects, because I think many of us are creating our own projects, and often I think you wear many hats as producer, director, writer, but do you have any tips for directing yourself in your own projects?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is to find someone you trust and have them there all the time. Like for me, I was directing myself, but it was also Jenny was at the monitor and we had so deeply the same vision about what the performance should be that she could just nod at me and I would understand like, okay, we got it and we can move on. And actually something Jenny came up with very early on, which is a tip that I wrote to America when she first started on Superstore, not when she first started directing on Superstore, was Jenny would say, okay, do two takes as the director or three takes as the director, and then do one where you forget that you're directing and it's just for you. And like, maybe it'll be different, maybe it won't, but do one take where you forget all of your other responsibilities and just kind of give those to the universe and perform for yourself. And when you came up with that, it really freed me up, because before that, like we have a take early on where I'm between, it's in the We're the Lady scene, and I'm between Jemima and Zasha, and I'm like literally like this between them, like,
yes, she's following, waiting. You're ahead of them.
Yeah, and
you're like, and then what are you going to say?
I know, because I was like so obsessed with monitoring their performance, and Jenny was like, take one that's just yours. And that, and then I think it really is about finding a partner, because like on Tiny Furniture, Alicia Vancouvering was with me every day, and I felt like we really had a clear understanding of who that character was. And I can only do it if I'm with somebody who I share a vision with.
And I would say, don't forget to put on your pants when you run to the monitors to watch playback.
And don't forget to eat. Every time I had a crisis of faith, Jenny would literally just be like, I don't want to upset you, but you would just like slide me a sandwich, and then I would eat it and I'd be like, we're having the best day.
Hi.
Hi.
So now that the show is completely wrapped up in this huge, important piece of your life, I'd imagine it feels like not necessarily coming to an end, but that it is now behind you, I guess, in a way. Do you look back at it, and is there a point in time where you feel like you wish you developed a character differently, or you wrote a scene differently, or do you watch back and think, I wish I could have, would have, or are you at peace with how everything is wrapped?
Mostly, we're not really regretty style people.
No, neither of us.
Also because we're like pretty good at learning from stuff we didn't like, so I would never say, I wish we did that differently, because I might never have learned the lesson that, you know, Hannah in a certain workplace to me seems cliche or something like that.
Something Jenny and I share, which I think is really helpful, is that neither of us is super into regret and neither of us is very jealous, like about we don't really covet other people's stuff. Maybe we're too self-involved, who knows? But
probably narcissism.
But yeah, I think what we do look back on is there are definitely moments, the only thing I wish, and I really enjoyed the shit out of the last two episodes, but there are definitely moments where I look back and I'm like, oh, Lena, you could have been like a quarter as hard on yourself and the same thing would have happened and you maybe would have gotten to like look around and appreciate it more. But I'm lucky that we're not done, so I can bring that to our next project.
The Lenny tour.
The Lenny tour.
Coming to a city near you.
Yeah, or not near you, because we're going across America to non-coastal elite cities, and we're very excited about it.
Tickets go on sale Friday, but they go on sale tomorrow if you're a Lenny subscriber.
So if you want to join, subscribe to Lenny tonight at LennyLetter.com, it wouldn't be a big issue. And I don't want to spoil anything, but I do have a Cher wig that I'm going to be wearing when I MC.
She's also requested a swing.
Yeah,
we don't know if
MC
we can afford
the swing.
It.
What is the Lenny tour?
Thank you Funny for asking, cast. America. The Lenny tour is...
I call it Lenneth Fair.
Lenneth Fair, Lenny IRL. We are going to be crossing the country with a group of 10 talented women who write, sing, share their poetry, do stand-up comedy. And it's going to be a night of joy and diversion and connection between women, with a portion of proceeds benefiting organizations that support young women in the arts.
Sounds amazing.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that we definitely learned from the election was how distant we felt from other places in the country besides the coastal cities. So this
Eric
is...
Eric and I went to some of those places together, and I was like, I remember we were in... There were a couple of places where we went, and we had, you know, Trump voters protesting outside of the Hillary headquarters, and I was like, I have really gotten the map of this country wrong.
Yeah, yeah. So we want to experience that and reach out to other people and just be out there and having fun and do like an old timey variety show in like Opry halls.
Yep, we're ready.
That sounds awesome. We have time for one more question.
I could do this all night.
There.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, you guys are fun.
You guys are great. These are really thoughtful, good questions.
Hi. Oh, my God. I had a question about casting Riz Ahmed, and at what point in the writing process you decided to cast Riz as, like, the baby's father, and, like, having your baby, have Hannah's baby be biracial. Like, did you guys have conversations about that, and what message you wanted to send to, like, the
audience? I'll be totally honest, which is we... became obsessed with Riz. We were just obsessed with Riz. We were watching Night Of. I had gone back and watched Four Lions. And what we really wanted out of that character was just somebody who felt as though they weren't equipped to be a father, but if you were to carry their child to term, it wouldn't be like a demon spawn,
right.
Basically.
Like, he didn't have to be the smartest guy in the world, but he had to be really sweet. And also, everyone we asked said Riz was an amazing improviser, which turned out to be true. And yeah, I mean, it really, it's the Night Of. Blame the Night
yeah,
Of.
Yeah, and he and I talked, and I just immediately connected with him, and I felt like he understood the character and had such a funny take on this sort of laid-back surfer guy. And then Hannah's child was biracial because Riz, although it wasn't something that we... Riz and I talked about it a lot and made a purposeful choice where we just felt like Paul Louis's ethnicity, his race, wasn't important to the dynamic, to the interaction that he and Hannah were having. If they'd had more time together, she could have delved into his past and understood what it was like to be, you know, a Pakistani kid growing up in Detroit, but that wasn't what their weekend together was about. And then as a result of the condomlessness, she had a biracial child. And I think we, you know, someone helpfully, sometimes I have people forward me articles that I don't want to read that much, but someone forwarded me something. They were like, Hannah failed to address that her child is biracial. And I was like, give her a second. He's 3 months old. She has terrible postpartum depression. Like, I want to believe that she will be able to have those important conversations with him and protect him in the world. But like right now, she's literally just trying to figure out how to breastfeed and how to like get him to go to sleep. And the conversations about what his life is going to look like and what his life is going to look like in this version of America, those will come later.
In the movie.
Yeah.
I want to give myself the privilege of asking the last question.
Yeah.
And I guess that's, you alluded to the first pilot episode deciding to take the abortion out of it and saying...
Switch it. To the second one.
Yeah, switch it to the second one. Because you thought that these four girls were all four girls who, give in that situation, that's what they would do. And then you ended the series with Hannah getting pregnant and having a baby. So if, in retrospect, there is an arc for Hannah and these girls, what would that be? If you could attempt to answer that question. The both of you.
I mean, I think one thing is that both times... we almost entirely avoid the question of, are you going to keep the baby? Like, and that is sort of interesting to me because, and I love that about our second episode, which is that they were a certain age, they were a certain group of girls, there was no version where Jessa was going to have that baby. So we never had that conversation.
We had one line, which is like, Jessa was, it was like, what, are you going to have a baby and take it to your babysitting job? And that was the entire
thing. Yeah. And then the conversation, really, that's sort of the big conversation after Patrick Wilson assumes that she's going to have it and she's like, no, I'm keeping the child. Then every conversation after that was basically a debate about whether to include the father. And I liked having the debates not be, will you keep it or will you not? And I do think Hannah comes full circle, even from the first episode where she's sitting across from her parents being so bratty and explaining why she deserves not to get cut off. And then in the last episode, she's giving advice to this young girl, giving away her pants to this young girl. And then, of course, she's Hannah, so she's going to turn on her and scream at her. But, and it will end in a Hannah way, but I do think that was our version of saying she's going to be okay as a mother. So that, it did feel like bookends to us.
Yeah, and it was exciting to kind of, I mean, it was a real litmus test for people because there were people who, to whom it seemed totally natural that Hannah would keep her child, and there were people who seemed like almost more scandalized than if she had made the other choice. And it was a really interesting thing to hear from people, and it seemed to really indicate where they were at. And Jenny made my favorite joke of all time where someone was like, is Hannah going to be a bad mother? And she was like, no worse than every character on every Showtime show.
Well, I just want to say from the bottom of my heart, and I'm sure so many others, thank you to the both of you for bringing this show into the world.
Aww. America,
we love you,
you
so much.
We love you so much. And we really do want you to run for office.
Yeah, but also if you don't watch Superstore, it is truly...
It is Lena's greatest passion. We both watch it. We both like it. Lena talks about it 3 to 4 times a day.
Yep, and I watch it every single night. I watch a rerun to be cozy before I go to sleep, and it's the show that like is the grandchild of Norman Lear's greatest works.
But I do want to say also that I want to go on record by saying, as wonderful as this show has been for our present day conversation, I do believe that you brought something into the world that will only fully be recognized in retrospect for the moment in history that you guys hold in television. So thank you for being here.
We love you.
We love you so much.
This conversation. Thank
We're
you, everybody.
We're so lucky.
Who's watching?
Thank you all.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night. Thank you so much.
The Tribeca Film Festival takes place every year in New York City. To learn more about all of our programs, head to TribecaFilms.com.